At Total Wine & More, find the best gifts for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for sis or a single barrel bourbon that dad will love. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21. Where can you find the best gifts at great low prices that everyone will love? At Total Wine & More, of course, with so many great bottles to choose from. Find something for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for your sis, sparkling wine for a coworker, or a single barrel bourbon for dad. And if you need any help, just ask one of their friendly guides for advice. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21.
Hey everyone, it's Kristen. This week, we are not doing a regular Genius Recipe Tapes episode. We are doing a special episode of Counter Jam, our podcast about food and music and culture with host Peter J. Kim. And this is because, as you've been listening along, you know that I have been working hard on the manuscript for the Genius Beginners Cookbook, and I need some time to finish up that. And I have been loving, as I do it, listening to Counter Jam and listening to all of Peter's guests and his own reflections on all of these things. So I have Peter here, and he is here to tell us more about this episode. Hi, Peter.
Hello, Kristen. Good to have you. Oh, sorry. Thanks for having me. I'm so used to being the host, and then so funny.
You know, that is the thing about these episodes is one of the things that I feel like it's doing for me right now is that it's sort of recreating the idea of going to a fabulous dinner party with like a really great playlist and a really like interesting set of people at the dinner party sharing experiences that I don't have, and something that we haven't really been able to do at all in the last year. So anyway, that's just an aside about the entire podcast, but I don't know if you have any thoughts on that before we dive into this specific episode.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, Kristen, because I hadn't necessarily quite thought of it this way, but it's true. Like, I mean, in a way it is a podcast embodiment of, I would say, my dream evening, which is generally speaking, having friends and loved ones over, sitting around a table, letting the wine flow, you know, eating and just like letting the conversation go. And then after, and listening to music along the way, of course. And then afterwards, a lot of my friends are musicians, segueing into like a jam session and playing music together. And to me, like, that's just like the perfect evening. And I hope that there's even the slightest feeling of that in the show.
There definitely is. And it's something that I think I've been missing and all of us have been missing. Just some sort of connection to people and to new things and new shared experiences too. Like, you know, finding out that we both love a certain kind of food or learning about a new kind of food, all of that is just really hard to do this year. And it's helping to look forward to when we can do it more again. So for this episode, you know, this felt like kind of the most emotional episode of the podcast so far. And I really appreciate that you tackle that and that you can go from, even in a single episode, you know, joking about like how annoying catcalls are with Yumi Nagashima to talking about Japanese internment camps in World War II and how those things can sort of connect and you know, that they're all worth talking about and worth exploring. And I don't know, do you have any feelings on that, like how you wanted to approach topics from weighty to light in your podcast?
Yeah, you know, often the way the show sort of works is I just will interview guests and then afterwards kind of find the themes that emerge from it. And in this case, it struck me at a certain point that I had three guests. One was a guest who immigrated to Canada herself, Yumi Nagashima. Another was a guest whose parents immigrated to North Carolina, and that's G. Yamazawa. And then there's another guest whose family had been in the U.S. for multiple generations, and that's Dan the Automator. And what I found so interesting, and, you know, take it with a grain of salt, because I think of the guests and the viewpoints expressed on the show generally to be data points that nobody should ever say, like, oh, now I understand the Japanese-American identity from this. But I did find it interesting to see and contrast the perceptions of their culture going along that spectrum. You know, in Yumi's case, she is still holding on very closely to Japanese culture, where she still thinks of like Canadian sashimi as being this awkwardly large thing that people shouldn't be dunking into soy sauce. In G's case, he grew up eating teriyaki chicken, loves it. You know, it's not like something that defines him, but it's a comfort food that he keeps coming back to. And then in the case of Dan, he didn't really grow up eating Japanese food as much. And when we dug into it, he hypothesized that it was resulting from the internment camps and Japanese Americans suppressing their cultural identity after the horrific experience there. And so when I had that kind of aha moment, I realized there was this really interesting continuum. And I think, you know, this episode really, for that reason, had the most interesting takeaway of any of the episodes in season one.
Yeah, it was incredibly poignant. And I think the moment that stuck out to me most was when G was sharing the poem about his dad and wondering if he would have wanted a different life than what was available to him as an immigrant trying to provide for his family. And that just, it seemed like that kind of struck a chord for you as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my parents were immigrants, small business owners, always working, and never really had a lot of options in their life except to kind of do what they could. And so that totally hit home.
Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that part of yourself and sharing your conversations with the guests. It's a really special episode, and I'm glad that we get to share it here.
Yeah. Thank you, Kristen.
Yo, yo, I'm Peter J. Kim, and this is Counter Jam on the Food 52 Podcast Network, where we celebrate culture through two of life's greatest things, food and music. This time, we're taking on Japanese-American food culture, the ups and downs of teriyaki, sushi stereotypes, and the immigrant hustle. And we've got a dynamite lineup. Comedian Yumi Nagashima, hip-hop producer Dan the Automator, and MC G. Yamazawa. This first track that you're hearing comes from G, and damn, it's a banger. It's called Northcak, which is slang for G's home state of North Carolina. To me, this song is a fist bump to hip-hop's essence. Dope groove, soulful lyrics, and ill MC skills. You've got to check out the music video, which was done in one long shot and features G laying it down while strutting down a North Carolina country road. It's so dope. So here's Northcak by G. Yamazawa.
It's the North Cat, baby, I'm a boss. Carolina barbecue sauce with the slaw. I'm the safe, the cellar, and the vault. I'm the best, the effect, and the cause, I'm the law. It's the North Cat, baby, I'm a boss. Carolina barbecue sauce with the slaw. I'm the safe, the cellar, and the vault. I'm the best, the effect, and the cause, I'm the law. I'm the truth, man, looking real false. Whenever I hit the booth, I come out to an applause. If I'm talking to my crew, you heard a sudden draw. Yo, I ain't talking to you, stop eavesdropping the ball. I be rocking with y'all, I be off of the wall. A pit bull off the leash, I keep locking my jaws. I see a cop at the mall, I see a cop at the vault. Peter picking a fight, I can see the Viking in y'all. One of my punchlines are where you're Viking off. I know I'm frightening y'all, long as a mic is involved. Relocated to Cali, but I ain't liking the smog. I'm a Southern North Star, I be the light in the dark. Be the right and the wrong, I be the reason the Bull City feeds me. Bull City grieves me, Bull City needs me. Everywhere I go, I got that Bull City greeting. That's why they throw the horns when the Bull City sees me. It's the North Cat, baby, I'm a boss. Carolina barbecue sauce with the slaw. I'm the safe, the cellar, and the vault. I'm the best, the effect, and the cause, I'm the law. It's the North Cat, baby, I'm a boss. Carolina barbecue sauce with the slaw. I'm the safe, the cellar, and the vault. I'm the best, the effect, and the cause, I'm the law.
And that was North Cat by G. Yamazawa. Peep the music video on YouTube. You won't regret it. I might not be Japanese-American myself, but I gotta say that the themes of this episode really hit home for me. It might on the surface be about Japanese-American food and identity, but we dig deep into the immigrant experience. As a child of immigrants myself, this is a topic that is deeply personal. And by the way, in this episode, I use the term American to mean North American, since Yumi Nagashima, our first guest, is Canadian. Yumi is a stand-up comedian who has made waves across Canada for her body, vulgar, no-holds-barred routine, which shatters any preconceptions you might hold about what a Japanese woman can or should say. Just by way of example,
her joke spin talking about her mom's bush and comparing her clitoris to edamame. She also loves skewering the often sexist and racist advances she receives from men. So, appropriately enough, we started by talking about how men like to hit on her on the street.
When I'm like walking on the street in Vancouver, and then when they want to, maybe like they want to get my phone number, or like they want to, like, you know, go on a date, like they go like, so like, oh, like, you know, are you Japanese? Like, they always make sure that I am Japanese. Are you Japanese? Like, they always say like, oh, I've learned a little Japanese before. Or like, I had a Japanese girlfriend before, something like that.
Yeah.
And then, hey, maybe like, maybe we should go for a sushi sometime. Like, that's what they always say.
And this works what, like 9 out of 10 times?
Yeah. Yeah. Without no fail, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, at least there's a point for them making a difference between Japanese and Chinese and Korean. So there's at least that.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah, I should be impressed.
That just speaks more to the low bar we have.
Yeah.
But I would say that the idea of women on the street saying to me, hey, baby, want to go get some kimchi, has happened to me precisely 0 times in my life.
And how do you feel about that?
You know, I feel a little left out, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, look, when they do this, they're just trying to compliment you, you know, put a smile on your face. Come
right.
on.
Right. But that's true. Yeah. I should evaluate the effort.
Well, it'd be a funny game, right? To stand out in the street and just shout out the like stereotypical food for their culture. Like, burritos, let's go get some burritos. Hey, you, how about we get some, shawarma? Oh, not shawarma hummus? Or like, am I close?
That's so funny.
Let me be clear. Under no circumstances should you ever A, hit on someone walking by, B, lead off any greeting to a stranger with, hey, baby, or C, try to guess what kind of food they want to eat based on what they look like. I mean, really, what's the end game here? Do they really expect someone to stop in their tracks and say, hey, you know what? I'd really love some sushi with you, random guy on the street who just heckled me. Anyway, back to Yumi's favorite stereotypes.
I don't like when people assume like, oh, like Japanese lady, you must be like so innocent, submissive. Yeah. And then like, so like caring and loving. That's the stereotype or like expectation almost they have. Like, not all Japanese ladies are like that. Like, we have personalities.
Yeah. And you're like, I'm actually full of hate.
Yeah.
Especially right now.
You can't be like full of rage. Yeah. And anger.
Yeah.
And a bit bitterness. Yeah.
I'm incredibly selfish. I don't care about other people. I hate everybody and everything.
Give me the space to be a badass. You know? Not a saint.
And I mean, do you feel that this stereotype has informed the way you do your comedy as well?
Yeah, I think so. When I feel like I had put in a container, it's like my instinct is to always like break the container. So like, yeah, I think it's what to do with it. Yeah.
Yes. This has always been a rule I've lived by too. When people box you in, break the damn box. Back when I would MC, I loved being able to walk up to a crowd, have them all assume I was some kind of chump who couldn't hold it down on the mic, and then proceed to shatter those expectations. I'd say I relished this to such a degree in my younger years that it actually interfered with my own understanding of my Koreanness. Anyway, I digress. It's a topic to be explored on a future episode. I talked to Yumi about the Japanese food she loves cooking at home.
I love ozoni. Sometimes we use chicken stock. Sometimes we use like seaweed stock or fish stock. and then put like lots of like seasonal vegetables and then put rice cake in it.
Mm.
And it's so delicious.
And so I saw on Instagram that you made some balls.
Balls?
They did look like very tasty balls.
Yes. What were they? Yes. Okay. Octopus balls. Yeah. It's called takoyaki. So white flour and like some egg. And then we put octopus, but like we didn't have octopus when we were filming the video. So like I put some shrimp and blue cheese. It's not very traditional. And then I put what else? Oh, and then again, sticky rice, of course. I put in there too.
I think that's kind of a winner. I mean, like shrimp, blue cheese, balls, like I could definitely crush that.
Yeah, you're gonna love it.
And is it typical to be singing a song while cooking?
Oh, it's mandatory, Peter. You have to sing while you cook, otherwise you just have to wait. So
do you always sing while you cook?
Yes, I tend to sing. Yeah.
And what kinds of songs do you sing when you're cooking?
Like it's all genres. Like I sometimes sing like Japanese pop songs, but sometimes I sing Beatles, but sometimes like I sing like you know, like some random stuff. It came to my mind. I make up songs for it.
I have to ask, and this is not just purely personal curiosity. You know Japanese city pop, right? The genre.
No.
Oh, okay. So it's something that, well, it's a music form that's actually quite popular, I think, among a certain crowd in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
And the song that kind of launched it was a song called Plastic Love.
Ah.
You don't know this song, Plastic
No.
Love?
No. I'm not Japanese anymore.
No, like I said, it's I suspect it's something that's more popular with non-Japanese Americans than with Japanese Americans.
Uh-huh. Okay, can you sing it to me, Peter?
Oh my God. I don't even know what the lyrics are, but it just gets me. It's in half of it's in English. But it's like it goes da 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 da. I'm sorry. That's the one part. It's like all of the does are like something that didn't work out, and then there's I'm sorry. Oh man, Yumi has since become part of the Plastic Love fan club, and if you haven't heard the song, then you should too. It's way catchier than my a cappella version, I promise you. Before Yumi was an accomplished comic, she started out in Canada like so many immigrants in the service industry. She was a waitress at various Japanese restaurants in Vancouver, where she was struck by the way Japanese food looked in her new hometown.
The sashimi is like so much like thicker than like I see in Japan, like just thick. And then we serve, and then usually like we put like a tiny bit of like soy sauce just to like enhance the flavor of sashimi. I saw like lots of customers in Canada, they put like crazy amount of soy sauce in a dipping bowl, and it's kind of like the fish in soy sauce swimming.
For most of my life, this was the food I knew of as Japanese food. Glossy teriyaki chicken, big multi-ingredient maki rolls separated by little plastic green dividers, and a big old cup of soy sauce and bright green wasabi, which is usually actually just horseradish masquerading as wasabi. Now, before you scoff at it, and you shouldn't, because this version of Japanese food can still be quite delicious, ask yourself, why did the cuisine morph in these ways? Well, it's likely out of entrepreneurship, immigrant restaurant owners adapting their home cuisine to sell food to new audiences. In other words, it's a product of adaptation. Next, we're going to hear firsthand from someone who grew up in a Japanese-American restaurant, North Carolina rapper G. Yamazawa. Stay tuned. Before we dig into my conversation with G, I want to play a clip of another one of his songs. You heard North Keck right at the beginning of the show, but this is quite a different kind of song. It has a haunting loop, a thundering beat, and the lyrics speak for themselves. Here is the song, Dining Room, by G. Yamazawa.
On my waiting tables, Papa in the kitchen. Emily was hostess, I was doing dishes. We was trying to make a living on the come up. I'ma stay true no matter what I do. Raised in a family serving food. Just made sure I wasn't in a dining room. Cause mama waiting tables. Mama waiting tables. Papa in the kitchen. Papa in the kitchen. Emily was hostess. Emily was hostess. I was doing dishes. We was trying to make a living on the come up. Come up. Come up. I'ma stay true no matter what I do. Cause I was raised in a family serving food. Just made sure I wasn't in a dining room. Mama always had a dream that she could speak English. Translating in America. 50 state of mind. Never had the capital to be a star in the field. Ended up putting fish on a clean dish. Never felt so defeated. How did she even interpret her feelings? Her mama was dancing, her sister was singing, her husband was hopeful. Mayumi was dreaming. Mayumi was dreaming. I seen her balance 10 plates with 5 fingers. What a talent to be openly sharing your culture with strangers. Slowly but surely she showed me the way of the shogun. His patience came to Durham, set up shop in the city, serving that maki unagi nigiri, sipping that sake asahi kirin. We be thanking that food that we eat. Cause mama waiting tables.
Mama waiting tables.
Papa in the kitchen.
Papa in the kitchen.
Emily was hostess.
Emily was hostess.
I was doing dishes. We was trying to make a living on it. Come up, come up, come up. I'ma stay true no matter what I do. Raised in a family serving food. Just made sure I wasn't in a dining room. In that dining room. In that dining room. Stay away from that dining room. Georgie Cook, what are you doing? Get out of that dining room, boy. How many times I gotta tell you? Customers eyeing you. Get out that dining room.
Ooh, damn. That is Dining Room by G. Yamazawa. I asked him to tell me about the inspiration behind the song.
Yeah, I started out rapping young, and long story short, I kind of fell into poetry in my late teens, early 20s, and just taking it really seriously, poetry slams. And so through that whole experience of poetry slams, I got heavy into telling my story, getting into my cultural identity, which was something I never explored in my art before that. And so I had a deep understanding and kind of like comfortability when it came to talking about my cultural heritage. And when I started rapping, it was kind of like I hadn't done that with music yet. And when my homie, you know, Ben Trill first sent me that beat, I felt like I was just in the restaurant, and it was the first time like music really translated an entire experience. And I just knew that that song was going to be about the restaurant, and the restaurant particularly was something that I had never really specifically dove into as far as the poetry was concerned, and what it meant to me. And I think how it also related to the way I treat my art and the way I present myself and present my work to the world. It mirrors my parents so much. So yeah, I just wanted to kind of write an ode to them. And it still gets me choked up when I hear that beat. It's just,
So I think this is a common sentiment among children of immigrant parents. One thing that will always get me choked up too is talking about my parents, their hustle, and how they scratched out a living in the U.S. They both came separately on one-way tickets in the 1960s, without much money, without knowing anyone. I mean, they met each other in the U.S. And with the trauma of the Korean War fresh in their minds. Flash forward to the 1980s, I exist and my parents are small business owners in East Central Illinois. They have Hallmark stores. I spend a lot of time in those stores. And I see, up close, how much heart and soul they put into those greeting cards, those precious moment figurines, those ornaments. I asked G to tell me about his family's restaurant.
They opened up in 86, I believe. They've been in that. They at one point had two locations, and, originally was like a classic Japanese, you know, joint, curry and udon and tempura and sushi and bento boxes. And then over the years, especially as they've gotten older, and in the last, I'd say 8 years, they've been doing kaiseki traditional dining. And so it's a course meal, and they only take reservations, and they only serve about 4 to 6 people a night. So really, really small operation, just my parents and one other employee. My mom goes on a kimono, and they only work 2 to 3 nights a week. And they're really in love with it. So yeah, 34 years strong, and I think they have 2 more years in them, and then they're gonna move to something else.
Yeah, I mean, and when they do, they're gonna be like, "What do we do with all this
time?" They're really, it's actually really interesting the way my work, and as I've grown and have gotten more of an audience, it's sort of we both kind of feed off of each other, and I think that we inspire each other actually, even though cooking is very far from my skill set and rapping is very far from anything that they understand. I think that we both kind of see each other and push each other to just keep being sincere and doing the best we can. So.
Yeah. So one of the things that really struck me about the music video is, you know, you have that sort of opening shot of the platter with the shrimp and the maki and other things, and this really beautiful, pristine restaurant front. And then you go further back, and you go further back, and then you're in the kitchen, and, you know, it's not a glamorous setting back in the kitchen. And to me, what that said to me was there's sort of a duality of the experience of that restaurant, of being a customer or being on the other side. What was it like? And I know you're saying the restaurant sort of evolved over the years, but what was it like growing up with the family business?
Oh, man, it's so interesting. When you were talking about your family's business, I just, there's just this element of you feeling so far from any like bigger corporate or just bigger institution of this country, where you just are in this, you're in your own world for real every day. And yeah. I think for me, it was interesting to kind of be going through the worlds in my own head in a way that I'm sure my parents weren't. And, you know, it's also interesting the way you learn about people, in a restaurant setting. Like I would wash dishes, right? And it's funny cause I talk about it all in the song, but like, I wasn't heavy working. Yeah. I was like 11, 12 years old or a little kid just standing on a crate. But like, I don't know, you see the way whole bowls of rice get left, you know, and not eaten, you know, and waste, you know, all you see all this food getting wasted, and you feel, I used to see the way it made my parents feel. And, and I don't know what that really says. I don't know exactly what I'm trying to say, but, there's an element of pride that comes from the restaurant that, you know, you do your best you know, ultimately at the end of the day, you're trying to make a living and you're trying to make a check. But how do you do that while maintaining your integrity and the love for what you do?
Yeah, I mean, and speaking of, so you were saying that early on, the menu was sort of a adapted menu of food that would appeal to sort of mainstream American tastes.
Yeah, we had Tar Heel rolls, Blue Devil rolls. Hurricane
Wait,
roll.
What's a Tar Heel?
Honestly,
roll?
I couldn't even tell you. And it's actually really funny. Like I was a classic American kid in a lot of ways. And I hated the smell of raw fish. I hated sushi growing up. And so I couldn't even tell you what was in these rolls as a kid. I really rejected a lot of it. But my parents were creative, man. And they understood what kind of tastes and what kind of, presentations would sell. But also, I thought it was it's a dope way to adapt and to feel like you are contributing and you are a part of the community that you're in.
Were your parents actually culinarily trained before they opened up the restaurant?
My dad was, yeah. He had been cooking since he was 18. And he was in Florida doing teppanyaki and doing tricks, and apparently he wasn't very popular. Like he wasn't like a likable guy at the restaurant back then. And so he liked
it. Isn't teppanyaki all about the show?
Yeah,
shit,
I mean, teppanyaki is such an American thing. It's funny, you know, I was in Japan and they're just like, you know, they're like, that is not it's not a thing.
Well, that's what I was saying. Is like, I think of Japan and Japanese culture and you feel like generally things are kind of understated. And you think about teppanyaki and it's like so over the top. Like I'm catching a flaming shrimp in my like hat or whatever. You know what I mean?
It's dope, though. I think it's, you know, it makes sense in a way.
Like, what did you have for, like, family meal at the restaurant?
Teriyaki, a lot of teriyaki, man. And it's funny, like, I just moved back, and so they've been teaching me how to make it, which is some shit I should have been learned how to make a long time ago. Man, I'm burning the hell out of the chicken. Yeah, yeah. And, but, yeah, teriyaki and karaage, like fried chicken. I love tempura growing up as well. Yeah, those were the go-tos. Yakimeshi, fried rice.
So I gotta ask then. So what is the Yamazawa technique for teriyaki then?
Man, throw the chicken in, season that mug, throw the meat in and the soy sauce in there, and just get it going, man. It's simple as fuck. It's just the easiest shit ever. But it's just so comforting, man. I don't know what it is. Yeah,
I feel it's like that combo of like sugar and soy. That just, it's like a magic thing.
Okay, hungry right now, man. I'm just, yeah.
So about teriyaki, it turns out that Yumi has a pretty different perspective on teriyaki.
In Nagashima family hold, like, we never had teriyaki.
You never had teriyaki?
Never. No. It's like, no, we don't have like teriyaki sauce or anything at home.
Well, what did you eat then?
I know, right? I know. It's like Western people love teriyaki sauce.
The joys and woes of teriyaki sauce aside, for many immigrant households, especially ones in which the parents are working nonstop, often the work of transferring cultural knowledge falls to the grandparents.
You have a poem that really moved me, which was called Dear Grandma. And you referred to... you make a lot of references to her cooking and that, and her feeding you. Was she was living with you? Did she come from Japan? Like, what side of the family was she from?
Yeah, so the my grandma, my mom's mom, in that poem, and she was here for the last 15 years of her life, and so, and that for me was like end of middle school, all through high school and into the poetry and early 20s, and you know, she was here originally for my mom to be able to take care of her. And of course there was this like mutual understanding of her being able to help out as much as she can as well. And so, yeah, man, she was, as I was getting into poetry and even at the time in the poetry experience where I realized I hadn't ever written anything about my culture. The piece about my grandma was the first time I kind of like realized like, wow, what a privilege, and what a special thing to be able to like live with my grandma, this walking, you know, piece of my history and my culture and my lineage. And for it to be a really kind of simple but profound thing, to wake up to and go to sleep with every night.
And your grandma, did she cook a lot at home then?
Yeah. I mean, one thing also, just when my parents running a restaurant, like they were never home, man, growing up, you know, they never were. They were just working 6-7 days a week. And so, my grandma just whip up something whenever, you know, grandma just whenever you hungry, man, they get it going. And so.
Can you remember some things that she would make for you?
Man, rice balls, like, you know, yakimeshi, just simple stuff. She could fry up chicken and. Again, it was a real bare bones menu for me. You know, I just mainly chicken, beef, rice, in any iteration.
I had a grandma who also came over to take care of me while my parents were also working their asses off at the Hallmark store. And it's funny. I mean, my grandma also made a lot of amazing Korean food for me. But like, what I associated her the most with was the way she made Kraft mac and cheese, because there was like. There was my mom's version of Kraft mac and cheese, which was the box of mac and cheese and like a little milk and like the tiniest sliver of butter. And then there's a Kraft mac and cheese that my brother would make for me, and that had like a proper like knob of butter in it. And then there was a Kraft mac and cheese that my grandma would make for me, and that was like, take the whole damn steak and just throw it in. And it's like, because why not, right? I mean, you got it.
Right.
And so it was just like, oh my God, like grandma mac and cheese is just the best.
That's fire. That's so far.
G grew up in a community that was decidedly not Japanese American. I asked him how he felt people perceived him.
maybe there's these mental blocks in my own head where I tried my best to just block out any sense of Asian identity as a kid. And I just tried my best to just fit in that, that I try to not acknowledge it. But yeah, you build this sort of, you get called Chinese so much that you catch yourself like having this attitude towards Chinese folks yourself, because you're just like, yo, I'm not Chinese. You have this internal conflict, even though you actually don't have no problem with Chinese folks or China for nothing. But you sort of take on. And I think that's a difficult thing about the beast, And at the same time, just trying to balance just the pride of it all is a difficult thing for a kid.
Yeah, man. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest, and I also similarly, when I was a kid, didn't really put my sort of Koreanness out there. And if anything, like you, I was just like trying to fit in. But there are all these moments that come up that really remind you, sometimes in a pretty harsh way, that you are actually a little different. The number of times kids would do that whole like Chinese, Japanese, dirty knees, look at these. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever got that on the playground.
Of course.
And then I remember I have this really distinct memory of this one kid. His name was Moses. He came up to me on the playground and he said, "Yo, man, like your face looks like it was hit by a truck." And I was like, and then I remember looking in the mirror afterwards, like kind of like touching my face. I'm like, oh man, yeah, like it's it's like flatter and like different, and so it's like you always get these little reminders, I feel like, of your differentness.
It just is like you just want to be taken seriously, and it's really hard to get there. Like you really hope and pray that people will want to know or find out more about who you are as a person beyond what you look like. And I think that goes for anybody who looks or seemingly is different from the norm. And I think what's great about it, though, is that it really makes you ask yourself, like, who are you? Who am I? And what, who do I want to be?
Well, one of your lyrics that really hit me hard from Dining Room, I'm going to read it. It was, "Seen him put a knife through a sea of dead dreams. Oh, but the life force that the dead brings. Slave to the work, wanna be set free. Made me wonder, would he resent me?" And I don't know what about it that was, but just like,
man,
I wanted to ask, if you're open to it, just to unpack that a little, what you meant by that.
Man, that part is the heaviest part for me too, actually. Yeah, talking about that song. I think it's just, I'm really in it exploring my pops, and I'm exploring what it's like, what it was, could have been like for him to sort of resort to the knife and to the cooking, sort of wondering, like, were there other dreams that you wanted to pursue? Were there other things that you would have enjoyed more, that you were more passionate about besides cooking? And and ultimately kind of like, me being his child and his family and needing to provide for his family, if you could do it over again and you didn't have to worry about kids or putting food on a table, would you have experimented and tried some other shit? So it's about, exploring him and whether this is something that is, was there other things out there that you wish you could have done as opposed to being in here cooking?
Yeah, because it's like in a lot of ways their life kind of drove them to do things, one after another. It's not like there was the ability to just be like, I want to be a painter, so I'm going to do that, So I feel you, man. I think it's crazy to think that they just never had the option to pursue those endeavors.
Mm-hmm. But I think the life force that the dead brings is like, this is the way that something, maybe this dead dream could have been this sustaining force that allow, there's all these other possibilities and life to sort of recur. And so, it's heavy shit, man.
Papa always had a dream, but I never really knew. He couldn't remember, so I never had a clue. He never had a friend, no ace, boom, coon. Guess I got left in his hometown, too. Now he had to take a job that he didn't really choose. Had a strong voice that he couldn't really use. That's why immigrants be cooking that food. It's the only way to communicate with you. Seen him put a knife through a sea of dead dreams. Oh, but the life force that the dead brings. Slave to the work, wanna be set free. Made me wonder, would he reset me?
Ooh, yeah. Heavy stuff indeed. I took it a few steps further with Dan Nakamura, a.k.a. Dan the Automator, a Japanese-American producer who reshaped the sounds of hip-hop with his avant-garde work with Gorillaz, Handsome Boy Modeling School, Dr. Octagon, and Deltron 3030, all groups that I love. Dan grew up in San Francisco, and he ate Japanese food, but unlike Yumi and G, for him, it wasn't the focus.
You know, if you grow up in a traditional Korean or a Chinese household, you know, you're probably like, you know, you got kimchi marinating on the side, you know, these things, you know, like we didn't have that.
So what's one key difference between Dan's family's history and the stories of G, whose parents immigrated, and Yumi, who immigrated herself? It's not pretty.
I'm Japanese American, but I'm also like third and a half generation essentially. So my great grandfather came here, and my grandparents were born in Hawaii. I think one couple were born in Los Angeles and went back to Hawaii. But anyway, Hawaii, LA, and the reason I mention that is A, to give the generation part, but also to mention, you know, they were all in internment camps in World War II.
Right.
And Japanese Americans. My experience is, and it's not my parents' experience, because when I talk to them about this, they don't agree with me. But I think being imprisoned made, and they were like very little, like, you know, 2-3 years old or whatever. But being imprisoned, they subverted the culture a lot growing up and into life. You know what I mean? So like, I find the Japanese community more than like say Korean or Chinese or whatever to have subverted the actual Japanese culture, at least the Japanese American ones. That being said, of course, you know, there's a lot of culture involved. It's just not in the same traditional way you might find in other ethnic groups.
Right. So actually, could you explain that a bit more? What do you mean by subverting Japanese culture?
Like I said, this is only my opinion. If you ask my parents someone, they'll say no. But like, it's like they worked very hard to be very American. You know what I mean? And it's not like, oh, you can't have Japanese food or we can't. Well, none of them spoke. My parents don't even speak Japanese really that much. I mean, my mom doesn't at all. My dad knew because his mom spoke it. But like, it was never like a language being spoken. But even I'm saying in the other households of people I knew growing up, the grandparents to the parents sometimes spoke the language, but not really the kids to the parents, you know?
Right.
And I think personally, like, there was a lot of like, you know, you don't want to like, two things. You don't want to like stick out too much or you might get chopped off. But also like, you know, ethnically, I don't think you want to like fly that flag too hard. You know, you can go to jail. My parents grew up separately in Chicago, but they, Chicago actually has a very big Japanese population because, the other thing that I should mention is Japanese don't talk about shit. So like we learn all this stuff like when someone dies or something. Right. But like
what
we learned is, in the camps, they would let you leave the camps. I think it was like 10 months to a year early if you agreed to move away from the coast. So that's how all these people ended up in Chicago.
So yeah, this is your not so friendly reminder that our country incarcerated at least 120,000 Japanese Americans in concentration camps for 4 years from 1942 to 1946. A horrific act that was ordered by then-President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. This is not ancient history by any means. I mean, we're talking about Dan's parents here. I'll admit, I never considered one consequence of this, the chilling effect on culture. Dan's story is anecdotal, of course, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were other Japanese Americans who suppressed their culture after experiencing this.
I don't think my mom or even my dad really ever learned to like be making Japanese food. You know what I mean? Like they know the parts of it that they knew. You know what I mean?
A lot of folks who are fans of Dan, such as myself, may not have ever considered Dan as a Japanese American musician. He's just known as an insanely talented beat producer. And Dan spoke to this.
Asians, and I'm not saying this in a negative way, it's a positive way, but they really want to embrace their own and make it be their own. Yeah. And by doing so and playing into that, you kind of make your own glass ceiling in arts, not in everything. It's like a club that you are happy to be a part of, and it's a club that also doesn't want you to leave the club.
I totally know that, yeah.
So when I was doing my stuff, I didn't want to be the best Japanese guy or the best Asian guy. I wanted to be the best, period.
I asked each of our guests my favorite little question, what their desert island Japanese dish would be. Here's Dan's.
It would actually be sushi. You get like the rice, plus you get the clean fish thing, and like, you know, and it has to have real wasabi though. So if I have to eat that all the time, we need that, you know?
When I asked G, he lit up and he knew right away.
Man, probably chicken teriyaki, man. Probably just a just a big thing of rice and just get it in, man.
Yumi's was a little more elaborate.
I know this secret weapon. Japanese bento box.
Uh-huh. That's cheating.
Yeah, kinda. There's like really perfectly cooked white rice. And then there's like tofu and seaweed miso soup. And then there's like a tiny portion of potato salad, just to change the flavor palette once in a while. And then there's like this grilled barbecue sardine on the plate, just like whole fish, boom. And then there's like grated radish and then lemon juice that you can squeeze like lemon juice.
And then you cover it with teriyaki sauce and dip the whole thing in soy sauce, right?
Yeah, just to get rid of all the flavor, you know.
We're going to close things out with a track from Dan the Automator that might surprise you. It's called Close to You by the group Gotta Girl. And it's not so much hip-hop as it is 1960s French pop. Crazily enough, Gotta Girl was a collaboration between Dan and the actress Mary Elizabeth Winstead. The album it appears on is called I Love You, But I Must Drive Off This Cliff Now. I love Mary's breathy vocals on top of Dan's lush soundscape. It's a perfect way to round things out for the show. Enjoy Close to You by Gotta Girl. Shout out to our guests, Yumi Nagashima, G Yamazawa, and Dan the Automator. Shout out to G, Dan, and Gotta Girl for providing the music for the episode. Shout out to the Food 52 team, and especially Coral Lee, the all-seeing eye who makes the magic happen. If you like the show and you want to hear more, give it a friendly review and subscribe. It really helps. I'm Peter J. Kim, and I'll catch you on the next episode of Counter Jam.